Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Helping the Suicidal Person, Tips and Techniques for Professionals by Stacy Friedenthal. Narrated by Anne Sprinkle. Author's Notes. For the sake of gender neutrality, this book uses the pronouns they, them, or their when referring generically to an individual. All of the author's clinical case scenarios are fictional, and any resemblance to a person is coincidental. Introduction. Every year, tens of thousands of mental health professionals sit face to face with people who reveal a wish to stop living. In the U.S. alone, in a single year, an estimated 10 million adults and 2 million adolescents seriously consider suicide. Of these, more than 40,000 die by suicide. Suicide's devastation underscores the importance of solid training and skills in suicide risk assessment and intervention. Even so, graduate education in schools of psychology, social work, counseling, and marriage and family therapy include little training on how to help a suicidal person, according to the psychologist William Schmitz and colleagues. They note, "Competence in the assessment of suicidality is an essential clinical skill that has consistently been overlooked and dismissed by the colleges, universities, clinical training sites, and licensing bodies that prepare mental health professionals. Given suicide's profound toll, this omission is stunning." These gaps in education often leave professionals ill-equipped to answer crucial questions about helping people at risk for suicide. What can therapists say and do, and not say and do, to learn whether a person is considering suicide? What are fruitful and sensitive ways to explore the depths of the person's suicidal wishes? How can therapists gain insight into the suicidal person's level of danger, and what can they do to help ensure the person's survival? How can therapists help the suicidal person respond constructively to destructive thoughts, rediscover hope, diminish the pain that leads to suicidal thinking, shed the wish to die, and build resilience? The aim of this book is to answer those questions. About the book. This book provides a highly practical toolbox for mental health professionals. Some books on working with suicidal clients focus primarily on suicide risk assessment, not treatment. Those that go beyond risk assessment often are either academic in tone or quasi-treatment manuals focused on a single theory or approach, leaving out the many other techniques that abound. Helping the Suicidal Person, Tips and Techniques for Professionals, is different. In a conversational style, it gives concrete advice for real-world practice. The techniques described here can be interspersed into any type of therapy, no matter what your theoretical orientation is, and no matter whether it's the client's first, 10th, or 100th session with you. Every tip is followed by a clinical vignette, or less commonly, an elaboration on a technique. The book covers diverse aspects of helping the suicidal person, starting with examining your own personal experiences and fears, and moving into covering the essential areas of risk assessment, safety planning, and treatment planning, and then providing a rich assortment of tips for reducing the person's suicidal danger and rebuilding the wish to live. The tips generally are ordered according to where in the therapeutic process you would encounter the specific issue with a person. For example, you will need to be well-versed in techniques for openly discussing suicide and uncovering suicidal ideation in order to conduct a solid risk assessment, so those tips come first. A section on helping the person after a suicide attempt comes late in the book because it will not apply to all suicidal individuals. The tips and techniques come from a wide variety of theories and interventions, including cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, solution-focused therapy, problem-solving therapy, the collaborative assessment and management of suicidality, and the attempted suicide short intervention program. Other tips draw from professionals' years of experience, including my own. A note about empirically supported treatments. Mental health professionals are called upon to use techniques that work. With suicidal people, effective treatments truly can make the difference between life and death. Additionally, the scarcity and expense of resources make it important to use interventions with an established record of effectiveness. The use of empirically supported treatments in suicide prevention, however, is tempered by the constraints of real-world practice and research. Suicide research presents extraordinary challenges. Foremost, the rarity of suicide limits our ability to study it. To detect whether an intervention can reduce suicide by 15% in 1 year in the general population, researchers would need to give the intervention to 13 million people. Researchers would need a much smaller sample if they used a high-risk sample, such as people who recently attempted suicide. Even so, such a study would still require 45,000 people. As a result of these logistical challenges, studies tend to look at whether an intervention reduces suicidal ideation and suicide attempts, not suicide itself. Several treatments have demonstrated effectiveness at reducing suicidal ideation or suicide attempts, including cognitive behavior therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, problem-solving therapy, the collaborative assessment and management of suicidality, and the attempted suicide short intervention program. Ideally, you will learn one or more of these empirically supported interventions in depth and adhere to its guidelines. Many of the book's tips and techniques draw from these established interventions. Helping the Suicidal Person, Tips and Techniques for Professionals, also contains tips and techniques that have no research studies documenting their effectiveness in isolation of other techniques, if at all. Many of the suggestions are simply common sense. To name just a few examples, understand how your own biases can affect your work with suicidal individuals. Frankly explore the person's suicidal thoughts, planning, and intent. Respond with empathy, validation, and a sincere desire to understand. Understand the cultural context of the person's suicidal thoughts. Seek consultation. A technique's lack of evidence of effectiveness is not the same as lack of effectiveness. Oftentimes, it simply means that the intervention has not yet been tested. Consider the case of parachutes. As a satirical, but factual, research article cleverly noted, no randomized controlled trial demonstrates that a parachute saves lives when someone jumps out of an airplane. Real-world experience takes precedence over the lack of research when it comes to parachutes. The same context exists for many techniques for reducing suicide risk. Even when evidence of effectiveness exists, people often do not conform to what research findings predict. It is up to you to monitor whether your interventions help your unique clients. After all, in the research landscape of randomized controlled trials and sophisticated statistical analyses of vast data sets, a lone person's outcomes are considered the least important evidence of effectiveness. To that person, those outcomes are the most important of all. A note about the term suicidal. For the sake of parsimony, I use the term suicidal throughout the book to characterize anybody who is thinking of ending their life. Suicidality exists in degrees. At one end of the continuum are people who only occasionally have suicidal thoughts and reject them immediately. At the other end are people so consumed by suicidal urges that they are moments away from ending their life. Every suicidal person needs a safe and non-judgmental space to discuss suicidal wishes, tips 8 through 18, and a comprehensive suicide risk assessment, tips 19 through 33. Beyond that, the tips and techniques to use depend on where the person lies on the continuum of suicidality. A person who unequivocally intends to die by suicide today is not in a place to make a hope kit, tip 64, come up with coping statements, tip 69, or practice mindfulness, tip 74. Instead, you will want to focus on maintaining the person's safety, whether via hospitalization, tip 35, safety planning, tip 38, removal of firearms from the home, tip 40, reducing access to other means for suicide, tip 41, or some combination of those measures. Where extreme risk for suicide is not present, the agenda moves on to planning treatment, tips 44 through 50, reducing psychological pain, tips 51 through 54, exploiting the person's ambivalence about suicide, tips 55 through 59, building hope, tips 60 through 65, helping the person change or diffuse suicidal thoughts, tips 66 through 72, strengthening coping skills, tips 73 through 76, and working to prevent another suicidal crisis, tips 85 through 89. In short, this book describes tips and techniques for helping anyone who lies anywhere on the suicidal spectrum, but not all techniques are appropriate with everyone. You should use these techniques according to your client's unique needs and circumstances. 1. Understanding suicide and you. Tip 1. Reflect on your biases about suicide. Your ethical, moral, and philosophical conceptualization of suicide will have direct and indirect influence on your clinical practice. Dana Wirchel and Robin Gearing. Mental health professionals need to have a solid understanding of their attitudes toward suicide and suicidal behavior. Whether they consider suicide to be a sin or a right, their stance can negatively influence assessment and treatment, even outside of their awareness. Professionals who view suicide as unequivocally wrong may have difficulty listening non-judgmentally as a person describes compelling reasons for wanting to die by suicide. Conversely, people who view suicide as permissible might hesitate to thwart an individual's suicide, leading to an avoidable tragedy. In many smaller ways, a professional's stance toward suicide prevention can disrupt treatment. To examine your attitudes toward suicide prevention, consider the following questions. What do you believe about people who attempt or die by suicide? Do you believe suicide should always be prevented? Why or why not? And if you do not believe it should always be prevented, under what circumstances should a person be permitted to die by suicide without intervention? Do you view suicide as selfish? Why or why not? Do you view suicide as cowardly? Why or why not? Is suicide a sin? Again, why or why not? Under what circumstances would you consider suicide for yourself? If it seems incomprehensible to want to kill yourself, why? The purpose of these questions is to jumpstart your honest examination of your suicide-related beliefs. There are no right or wrong answers. However, myths, biases, and logical inconsistencies shape some people's answers, and they are considered in the following. Should suicide always be prevented? This question, like the others, contains no right or wrong answer, but inconsistency can be revealing. Examine whether your response differs based on the person's age, physical health, mental health, or life circumstances. Also consider how your views on suicide prevention could affect how you respond to a suicidal person, and what safeguards you take or neglect to take to ensure that your views do not interfere with providing the most effective and ethical care possible to the suicidal person. Is suicide selfish? Many people lament that people who die by suicide hurt loved ones and damage the community as a whole. The man whose suicide leaves behind a young widow to raise 4 children on her own, the teacher whose suicide profoundly scars her students. These kinds of deaths provoke accusations of selfishness. Almost always, however, people who die by suicide do so under the duress of mental illness, hopelessness, trauma, pain, or some other seemingly inexorable problem. It is questionable whether the person is to blame for actions that stem from forces beyond the person's control. The psychologist Thomas Joyner also disputes the notion of selfishness by pointing out that many people who attempt or die by suicide actually want to help the people they love, not hurt them. Falling for the lies of depression, hopelessness, or other mental pain, they often believe, mostly to the astonishment of their family and friends, that their suicide will make life easier for others. However misguided it may be, the wish to spare others is hardly selfish. Is suicide cowardly? Some people view suicide as taking the easy way out. Others note that it requires courage to overcome the survival instinct and actually end one's life. Is suicide a sin? This question summons deeply personal beliefs. Whatever your beliefs, it is worth noting that the major world religions once condemned suicide universally, but now make allowances for suicide that occurs as a result of mental illness or impairment. In closing, it is impossible to be neutral about suicide. Bias is inescapable. To not care one way or the other allows for the possibility that suicide should not always be prevented, which in itself is a bias. Uncover your own biases and make a plan for how to help someone in spite of them. The judgmental therapist. A clinical social worker for 5 years, Ashley held negative judgments about suicide. She believed suicide to be a sin, selfish, and cowardly. As a result, when she asked a client if they were thinking of dying by suicide and the person said no, she invariably responded by exclaiming, "Oh, good." Sometimes she would elaborate, "People who kill themselves are only thinking of themselves. It devastates those left behind." Her clients learned quickly that if indeed one day they did consider suicide, Ashley would judge them negatively. When that day came, some chose not to tell her, and others left treatment altogether. For the sake of her clients, when a client reports that they are not considering suicide, a better response would be, Would you be willing to tell me in the future if that changes for you? Tip 2. Take stock of your experiences with suicide, or lack thereof. Our own histories with suicide, whether that be our own suicidality, the loss of a loved one to suicide, or the death of a former patient to suicide, will greatly impact how we approach and respond to people who actively think about suicide. Nadine Caslow. Many mental health professionals have personal experience with suicide or suicidality. In one study of psychiatrists, psychiatric nurses, psychologists, and social workers, 43% reported ever having considered suicide, and 5% had made a suicide attempt. If mental health professionals are representative of the general population, then we can assume that half have known someone personally who has died by suicide, with almost 40% of those people reporting that the person who died was a family member. Suicide also touches professionals in their work. Studies indicate that 23% of professional counselors, 30% of psychologists and social workers, and 50% of psychiatrists have had a client die by suicide. These experiences with suicide cannot help but influence one's professional work with suicidal individuals. On the positive side, people with lived experience often have keen insight and empathy for others on similar journeys. On the negative side, there is the danger that lived experience with suicidality or suicide loss can give rise to rescue fantasies, over-identification, boundary violations, and even outright impairment. Subtler effects can also occur, such as avoiding asking or talking about suicide. Professionals who lost someone to suicide or experienced suicidality themselves need to explore how their experiences positively and negatively affect the ways that they talk about suicide with clients and the actions that they take or do not take as a result. If your self-examination reveals areas of concern, then awareness is not enough. You also need a strategy to manage your reactions to avoid doing harm. In general, personal psychotherapy, supervision, and consultation can help prevent past troubles from intruding on your present effectiveness. Can suicidal professionals help suicidal people? Many people with suicidal thoughts manage to observe the thoughts dispassionately, easily resist any urges to act on them, and recognize them as a symptom, not a powerful force or fact. This is a goal for our clients and a reality for many mental health professionals afflicted with a chronic mental disorder, such as major depression or bipolar disorder. In such cases, when the professional is detached from their suicidal thoughts and lacks any intent to act on them, then it usually is appropriate to continue seeing clients. If the suicidal thoughts gain strength and become seductive, then the professional must take extra measures to ensure fitness for practice. Therapists caught up in suicidal thinking can do harm to the people they are there to help. For example, a client's articulation of suicidal thoughts can draw the helping professional into an internal debate about whether to die by suicide, making it impossible for the professional to devote their full attention to the client. The psychiatrist, Sean Shea, recommends that mental health professionals who are experiencing suicidal thoughts receive mental health treatment and, separately, consultation or supervision. The treatment provider and the supervisor or consultant should communicate with each other and work collaboratively with the suicidal professional to assess whether the person can continue seeing clients without doing harm. can professionals without lived experience help suicidal people? A person's lived experience with suicidality need not be harmful, and it can actually be helpful. People who have survived a suicidal crisis may have insights into the experience that others lack. Jack Gorman, a former psychiatrist, writes of the awakening he had when, after decades of treating suicidal patients, he became dangerously suicidal. "I now realize that I never really understood what it means to want to die," he wrote in 2013. Gorman goes on to state that he had believed that suicidal individuals were frightened and confused by their self-destructive urges. Then he learned firsthand that suicide could seem perfectly rational, ethical, and even necessary to the suicidal person. A suicidal history is certainly not a requirement for effectively and empathetically helping suicidal individuals, just as someone without a history of addiction can be a good addictions counselor. But some people who have never personally experienced suicidal thoughts struggle to understand how someone could want to end their life. If that applies to you, I recommend reading memoirs by people who have survived a suicidal crisis. Here are just a few examples in which the author does a superb job portraying suicidal experiences. Cracked, Not Broken: Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt by Kevin Hines. An Unquiet Mind: A Memoir of Moods and Madness by Kay Redfield Jamison. This Is How It Feels: A Memoir, Attempting Suicide and Finding Life by Craig Miller. Darkness Visible: A Memoir of Madness by William Styron. Waking Up: Climbing Through the Darkness by Terry L. Wise. Now I React with Intention and Awareness.
Mama, where's Daddy?
Family lore has it that those were the first words Daquan ever spoke when he was almost 2 years old, just a few weeks after his father died by suicide. In adolescence, Daquan faced his own suicidal thoughts. He attempted suicide twice, once at the age of 16 and again at 22, before he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and stabilized with medication. Now 36 and a school psychologist, Daquan works at a high school for at-risk students. Students often disclose to Daquan that they are thinking about suicide or have made an attempt. At first, when Daquan started working at the school 5 years earlier, talking with suicidal students triggered painful memories and grief. A few times, he had to lock himself in his office and cry at his desk. Then he found himself avoiding the topic of suicide or changing the subject when students brought it up. Eventually, he resumed therapy and explored the open wounds from his father's suicide and his own suicide attempts, as well as the gifts of insight and empathy that his experiences provided. Daquan says the most valuable aspect of therapy was learning to ground himself in the present moment so that he could focus on the needs of the student sitting in front of him instead of getting lost in his past trauma. "I am no longer on autopilot," he says. "Now I react with intention and awareness. That wasn't always the case." Tip 3. Confront Suicide Anxiety. The treater, who is held emotionally hostage by terror of the patient's suicide, cannot respond empathetically and helpfully. Thomas Gutile. Almost every mental health professional fears the loss of a client to suicide. It is a devastating outcome. In many cases, the professional feels overwhelming grief at the death of someone they cared about and tried to help. Feelings of incompetence, guilt, or inadequacy often emerge. Accusations of wrongdoing, a lawsuit, and a licensing board complaint may follow the suicide. Colleagues,
sample complete. Ready to continue?